Carlyle bangs on the door again. Her eyes flick to the door, then back to Anderson.
It is White Shirts,
she whispers.
There are many of them out there. I can hear them.
She suddenly seems to collect herself.
It will be White Shirts. Hiding will do no good.
Anderson fights the urge to scream at her. It's not White Shirts. The banging continues on his door.
Open the fuck up, Anderson!
He calls back.
Just a second!
He pulls on a pair of pants, glaring at her. It's not the damn White Shirts. Carlyle would slit his throat before he'd get into bed with White Shirts. Carlyle's voice again echoes through the door.
Hurry up, goddammit! Coming!
He turns to her, orders her.
Hide. Now.
Not a request anymore, but an order, driving at her genetic heritage and her training. Her body goes still. Then suddenly she becomes animated, nodding.
Yes, I will do as you say.
Already she is dressing. Her stutter motion is fast, almost a blur. Her skin gleams as she pulls on a blouse and a pair of loose trousers. Suddenly she's shockingly fast, fluid in her movements, strangely and suddenly graceful.
Hiding will do no good, she says.
She turns and runs for the balcony.
What are you doing?
She turns back and smiles at him, seems about to say something, but instead, she plunges over the balcony's edge and disappears into the blackness.
Emiko!
Anderson runs to the balcony. Below, there is nothing. No person, no scream, no thud, no complaints from the street as she spatters across the ground. Nothing. Only emptiness. As though the night has swallowed her completely. The banging on the door comes again. Anderson's heart thuds in his chest. Where is she? How did she do that? It is unnatural. She was so fast, so determined at the end. 1 minute on the balcony, the next gone. Over the edge. Anderson peers into the blackness. It's impossible that she jumped to another balcony, and yet, did she fall? Is she dead? The door crashes open. Anderson whirls. Carlyle spills into the apartment room, stumbling. What the? Black Panthers pour in after Carlyle, slamming him aside. Combat armor gleams in the dimness, military shadows. One of the soldiers grabs Anderson, whirls him about, and slams him into the wall. Hands search his body. When he struggles, they jam his face against the wall. More men pour in. Doors are being kicked open, splintering. Boots thud around him. An avalanche of men. Glass breaks. Dishes in his kitchen shatter. Anderson cranes his neck to see what is happening. A hand grabs him by the hair and slams his face back against the wall. Blood and pain flood his mouth. He's bitten his tongue.
What the hell are you doing? Do you know who I am?
He chokes off as Carlyle is dumped on the floor beside him. He can see now that the man is tied. Bruises pepper his face. One eye is swollen shut. Black blood scabs on the orbital bone. His brown hair is clotted with blood.
Christ.
The soldiers wrench Anderson's hands behind his back and bind them. They grab his hair and jerk him around. A soldier shouts at him, speaking so fast he can't understand. Wide eyes and spittle in his face as the man rages. Finally, Anderson catches words. Hichikichi.
Where is the wind-up? Where is it? Where? Where?
The Panthers tear through his apartment. Rifle butts to smash open locks and doors. Huge black wind-up mastiffs scramble inside, barking and slavering, snuffling everywhere, howling as they catch their target scent. A man shouts at him again, some kind of captain.
What's going on?
Anderson demands again.
I have friends!
Not many.
Akarat strides through the door.
Akarat!
Anderson tries to turn, but the panthers slam him back against the wall.
What's going on?
We have the same question for you.
Akarat shouts orders in Thai to the men tossing Anderson's apartment. Anderson closes his eyes, desperately thankful that the wind-up girl didn't hide in the closet, as he suggested, to be found with her, caught out. One of the panthers returns, carrying Anderson's spring gun. Akarat makes a face of distaste.
Do you have a permit to be armed?
We're starting a revolution and you're asking about permits?
Akarat nods to his men. Anderson slams back against the wall. Pain explodes in his skull. The room dims and his knees buckle. He staggers, barely keeps his feet.
What the hell's going on?
Akarat motions for the pistol. Takes it, pumps it idly, the heavy dull thing massive in his fist.
Where is the wind-up girl?
Anderson spits blood.
Why do you care? You're not a white shirt or a Grahamite.
The panthers slam Anderson against the wall again. Colored dots swim in Anderson's vision.
Where did the wind-up come from?
Akarat asks.
She's Japanese. From Kyoto, I think.
Akarat puts the pistol to Anderson's head.
How did you get her into the country?
What?
Akarat strikes him with the butt of the pistol. The world darkens. Water gushes into his face. Anderson gasps and splutters. He's sitting on the floor. Akarat presses the spring gun to Anderson's throat, pushing him to climb up to his feet again, then to teeter onto his toes. Anderson gags at the pressure.
How did you get the wind-up into the country?
Akarat repeats. Sweat and blood sting Anderson's eyes. He blinks and shakes his head.
I didn't get her in.
He spits blood again.
She was a Japanese discard. How would I get my hands on a wind-up?
Akarat smiles, says something to his men.
A military wind-up is a Japanese discard.
He shakes his head.
I think not.
He slams the pistol button to Anderson's ribs. Once, twice, each side cracking. Anderson yowls and doubles over, coughing and cringing away. Akarat drags him upright.
Why would a military wind-up be in our city of divine beings? She's not military!
Anderson protests.
She's just a secretary. Was just a...
Akarat's expression doesn't change. He spins Anderson around and forces his face against the wall, grinding bones. Anderson thinks his jaw's broken. He feels Akarat's hands prying his fingers apart. Anderson tries to make a fist, whimpering, knowing what is coming, but Akarat's hands are strong, prying them open. Anderson experiences a moment of tingling helplessness. His finger twists in Akarat's grip. Snaps. Anderson howls into the wall as Akarat supports him. When he's done whimpering and shaking, Akarat grabs him by the hair and pulls his head back so that they can look into one another's eyes. Akarat's voice is steady.
She is military. She is a killer. And you are the one who introduced her to the Samdet Chao Phraya. Where is she now?
A killer?
Anderson shakes his head, trying to think straight.
But she's nothing! A Mishimoto discard. Japanese trash!
The Environment Ministry is right about one thing. You agrigen animals can't be trusted.
You call the wind-up a simple pleasure toy and so conveniently introduce your assassin to the Queen's protector. He leans close, eyes full of rage.
You might as well have killed royalty! But that's impossible.
Anderson doesn't even try to keep the hysteria from his voice. His broken finger throbs, blood fills his mouth again.
She's just a piece of trash! She couldn't do something like that! You have to believe me!
She killed 3 men and their bodyguards.
8 trained men!
The proof is unassailable. Unbidden, he remembers Emiko huddled on his doorstep, soaked in blood.
8 men?
Remembers her disappearing over the balcony, plunging into darkness like some kind of spirit creature. What if they're right?
There's got to be another explanation. She's just a goddamn wind-up. All they do is obey.
Emiko in bed, huddled, sobbing, her body torn and scratched.
Anderson takes a breath, tries to control his voice.
Please.
You have to believe me. We would never jeopardize so much.
Agrigen doesn't benefit from the Somdet Chalpraya's death.
Nobody does. This plays right into the Environment Ministry's hands.
We have too much to gain from a good relationship.
And yet you introduced the killer to him.
But it's insane! How would anyone get a military wind-up here and keep it under wraps? That wind-up has been around for years and years. Ask around, you'll see. She bribed her way with the white shirts. Her papa-san had that show running for ages.
He's babbling, but he can see Akarat listening now. The cold rage is gone from the man's eyes. Now there is consideration.
Anderson spits blood and looks Akarat in the eye.
Yes, I introduced that creature, but it was only because she was a novelty. Everyone knows his reputation.
He flinches as a new surge of anger twists Akarat's face.
Please listen to me. Investigate this. If you investigate, you'll find out it wasn't us. There has to be another explanation. We had no idea.
He breaks off tiredly.
Just investigate.
We cannot. The Environment Ministry has the case.
What?
Anderson can't hide his surprise.
By what authority? The wind-up makes it a case for their ministry. She is an invasive.
And you think I'm the one behind it? When those bastards are controlling the investigation?
Anderson works through the implications, hunting for reasons, excuses, anything to buy time. You can't trust them. Pracha and his people. He pauses.
Pracha would set us up. He'd do it in a second. Maybe he's caught wind of our plans. He could be moving against us right now, using this as cover. If he knew the Somdet Chalpraya was against him...
Our plans were secret. Akarat says.
Nothing secret. Not in the scale we're working. One of the generals could have leaked to their old friend, and now he's just assassinated 3 of ours and we're pointing fingers at each other.
Akarat considers. Anderson waits, breath held. Finally, Akarat shakes his head.
No. Pracha would never attack royalty. He is garbage, but still, he is Thai.
But it wasn't me either!
He looks down at Carlisle.
It wasn't us! There has to be another explanation.
He starts to cough with panic, a cough that becomes an uncontrolled spasm. At last it stops. His ribs ache. He spits blood and wonders if his lung is punctured from the beating. He looks up at Akarat, trying to control his words, to make them count, to sound reasonable.
There must be some way to find out what really happened to the Somdet Chowpraya. Some connection. Something.
A panther leans forward and whispers in Akarat's ear. Anderson thinks he recognizes him from the party on the barge. One of the Somdet Chowpraya's men. The hard one with the feral face and the still eyes. He whispers more words. Akarat nods sharply.
Garp.
Motions his men to push Anderson and Carlyle into the next room.
All right, Kun Anderson. We will see what we can learn.
They shove him down on the floor beside Carlyle.
Make yourself comfortable, Akarat says. I've given my man 12 hours to investigate. You had better pray to whatever Grahamite god you worship that your story is confirmed.
Anderson feels a surge of hope. Find out everything you can. You'll see it wasn't us. You'll see. He sucks in a split lip. That wind-up isn't anything other than a Japanese toy. Someone else is responsible for this. The white shirts are just trying to get us to go after each other. 10-1 says it's the white shirts moving on us all.
We will see.
Anderson lets his head loll back against the wall. Adrenaline and nervous energy firing under his skin. His hand throbs. The broken finger dangles, useless. Time. He's bought time. Now it's just a matter of waiting, of trying to find the next finger hold to survival. He coughs again, wincing at the pain in his ribs. Beside him, Carlyle groans but doesn't wake up. Anderson coughs again and stares at the wall, collecting himself for the next round of conflict with Akarat. But even as he considers the many angles, trying to understand what has caused this rapid change in circumstance, another image keeps intruding. The sight of the wind-up girl running for the balcony and plunging into darkness, faster than anything he has ever seen, a wraith of movement and feral grace, fast and smooth, and at speed, terrifyingly beautiful.
Chapter 32. Smoke billows around Kanya. 4 more bodies discovered, in addition to the ones they'd already found in the hospitals. The plague is mutating more quickly than she expected. Gibu Sen hinted that it might, but the counting of bodies fills her with foreboding. Pai moves along the edges of a fish pond. They've thrown lye and chlorine into the pond, huge sacks. Clouds of acrid scent waft across everyone, making them cough. The stench of fear. She remembers other ponds filled, other people huddled while the white shirts ranged through the village, burning, burning, burning. She closes her eyes. How she had hated the white shirts then. And so when the local Jaupor found her intelligent and driven, he sent her to the capital with instructions. To volunteer with the white shirts, to work for them, to ingratiate herself. A country godfather. Working in concert with the enemies of the white shirts. Seeking revenge for the usurpation of his power. Dozens of other children went south to beg on the ministry's doors, and all of them with the same instructions. Of the ones she arrived with, she is the only one who rose so high. But there are others, she knows. Others like her, seated throughout. Other embittered, loyal children.
I forgive you, Jaidi murmurs. Kanya shakes her head and ignores him. Waves to Pai that the ponds are ready to be buried. If they are lucky, the village will cease to exist entirely. Her men work quickly, eager to be gone. They all have masks and suits, but in the relentless heat, these shields are more torture than protection. More clouds of acrid smoke. The villagers are crying. The girl Mai stares at Kanya, her expression flat. A formative moment for the child.
This memory will lodge like a fishbone in the throat. She will never be free of it. Kanya's heart goes out to her. If only you could understand. But it is impossible for one so small to comprehend the gray brutalities of life. If only I could have understood.
Captain Kanya!
She turns. A man is coming across the dike, stumbling in the mud of the paddies, stumbling through jewel-green rice shoots. Pai looks up with interest, but Kanya waves him away. The messenger arrives breathless.
Buddha smiles on you and the ministry.
He waits expectantly.
Now?
Kanya stares at him, looks back at the burning village.
You want me now?
The young boy looks around nervously, surprised at her response. Kanya waves impatiently.
Tell me again.
Now?
Buddha smiles on you, and the ministry. All roads start at the heart of Krung Thep. All roads.
Kanya grimaces and calls to her lieutenant.
Pai, I must go.
Now?
He masters his surprise as he comes over to her. Kanya nods.
It's unavoidable.
She waves at the flaming bamboo houses.
Finish up here.
What about the villagers?
Keep them roped here. Send food. If no one else sickens this week, we are likely finished.
You think we could be so lucky?
Kanya makes herself smile, thinking how unnatural it is to reassure someone with Pai's experience.
We can hope.
She waves at the boy.
Take me then.
She glances at Pai.
Meet me at the ministry when you have finished here.
We have one more place left to burn.
The Farang factory.
Kanya almost smiles at his eagerness.
We cannot let the source go uncleansed. Is that not our job?
You are a new tiger!
Pai exclaims. He claps her on the back before he remembers his station and wise apology for his forwardness, and then hurries back to the destruction of the village.
A new tiger?
Jaidi mutters beside her.
Very nice for you.
It's your own fault.
You trained them to need a radical.
And so they choose you?
Kanya sighs.
If you carry a burning torch, apparently it is enough.
Jaidi laughs at that. A kink spring scooter is waiting for her on the far side of the dikes. The boy climbs on and waits for her to perch behind, and then they are off through the city streets, weaving around megadonts and bicycles. Their little air horn blares. The city blurs past. Fish sellers, cloth merchants, amulet men with their prasubs, which Jaidi used to make so much fun of, and which Kanya secretly keeps herself, close to her heart, on a small chain.
Currying favor with too many gods,
Jaidi observed when she touched it before leaving the village. But she ignored his mockery and still whispered prayers to Prasub, hoping for protection that she knew she didn't deserve. The scooter slows to a stop and she hops down. The gold filigree of the city pillar shrine gleams in the dawn. All around, women sell marigolds for offerings. The chanting of monks carries over the whitewashed walls, along with the music of con dances. The boy is gone before she has a chance to thank him. Just another of the many who owe favors to Akarat. Likely the scooter is a gift from the man, and loyalty the price of it.
And what do you get, dear Kanya?
Jaidi asks.
You know, Kanya mutters. I get what I swore I would get.
And do you still desire it?
She doesn't answer him. Steps over the barrier door to the shrine's interior. Even at dawn, the shrine is crowded with worshippers, People crouched before the Buddha statues in the shrine of Prasub, second only to the one at the ministry. The grounds bustle with people making offerings of flowers and fruit, shaking out their fortunes with divining sticks, and over it all the monks chant, guarding the city with their prayers and amulets and the Sai Sin that stretches from the shrine to the dikes and pumps. The sacred thread wavers in the gray light, held aloft on poles, where it crosses thoroughfares, stretching miles from this blessed hub to the pumps, and then circling the sea walls. The monks' chanting is a steady drone, keeping the city of divine beings safe from the swallowing waves. Kanya buys her own incense and food offering, takes it into the cool confines of the pillar shrine, down the marble steps. She kneels before the old city pillar of sacked Ayutthaya and the larger one of Bangkok, the place where all miles are marked from, the heart of Krung Thep, and the home of the spirits that protect it. If she stands in the shrine's doorway and looks out toward the dikes, she can see the rise of the levees. It is obvious that they are in the depths of a bathtub. They are exposed on all sides, this shrine. She lights her incense and pays her respects. "Don't you feel like a hypocrite, coming here of all places at trade's whim?"
"Shut up, Jaidi." Jaidi kneels beside her.
"Well, at least you're giving some good fruit."
"Shut up."
She wants to pray, but with Jaidi bothering her, it's useless. After another minute, she gives up and goes back outside to the increasing morning light and heat. Narong is there, leaning against a post, watching the con dances. The drums beat and the dancers go through their stylized turns, their voices raised high and stark, competing with the drone of the ranked monks across the courtyard. Kanya joins him. Narong holds up a hand. "Wait until they're done." She masters her irritation and finds a seat, watches as the story of Rama is played out. Finally, Narong nods, satisfied. "It's good, isn't it?" He tilts his head toward the pillar shrine. "Have you made your offerings?"
"You care?"
Other white shirts cluster in the compound, making their own offerings. Asking for promotions to better-paying assignments. Asking for success in their investigations. Asking for protection from the diseases that they run up against every day. By its nature, this is a shrine for the Environment Ministry, almost as important as the Temple of Prasub, the biodiversity martyr. It makes her nervous to speak with Narong in front of them all, but he appears entirely unconcerned. "We all love the city," he says. "Not even Akarat will fail to defend it." Kanya makes a face.
"What do you want from me?"
"So impatient. Let's walk." She scowls. Narong seems unhurried, and yet he has summoned her as if it is an emergency. She tamps her fury and mutters, "Do you know what you've interrupted? Tell me as we walk."
"I have a village with 5 dead, and we still haven't isolated the cause."
He glances over, interested. "A new Sibiscosis?" He guides her out of the compound, past the marigold cellars, walking onward.
"We don't know."
She masters her frustration. "But you're delaying me from my work, and though it may please you to make me run like a dog when you call, we have a problem." Narong interrupts. "And though you think your village is important, it is nothing in comparison to this. There has been a death, a very prominent one. We need your help in the investigation." She laughs. "I'm not the police." "It's not a police matter. There was a wind-up involved." She stops short.
"A what?"
"The killer. We believe it is an invasive. A military wind-up. Hichikichi."
"How is that possible?"
"It is something we also are trying to understand." Narong looks at her seriously. and we cannot ask the question because General Pracha has taken control of the investigation, claiming jurisdiction because the wind-up is an interdicted creature.
As if it were a Cheshire or a yellow card.
He laughs bitterly. We are blocked entirely.
You will investigate on our behalf.
That's difficult. It is not my investigation. Pracha will not.
He trusts you.
Trusting me to do my job and allowing me to meddle are two different things. She shrugs and turns away. It's impossible.
No!
Narong grabs her and yanks her back.
This is vital. We must know the details.
Kanya whirls, throws Narong's hand off her shoulder.
Why? What is so important about this? People die all over Bangkok every day.
We find bodies faster than we can shovel them into methane composters. What's so important about this one that you'd have me cross the general? Narong pulls her close.
It's the Somdet Chapraya. We have lost Her Royal Majesty's protector.
Kanya's knees buckle. Narong drags her upright, keeps talking, fiercely insistent.
Politics has become uglier since I started in this game.
He has a smile on his face, but now Kanya sees the rage banked below.
You're a good girl, Kanya. We have always held our part of the bargain. But this is why you are here. I know this is difficult. You have loyalty to your superiors in the Environment Ministry as well. You pray to Prasub, this is good. It is right for you. But we require your help. Even if you have no taste for Akarat anymore, the palace requires it.
What do you want?
We need to know if this was Pracha's doing. He has been quick to take over the investigation. We must know if it was he who drove the knife. Your patron and the safety of the palace depends on this. It is possible that Pracha wishes to hide something. It could be some of his December 12 elements striking against us.
It's not possible.
It is too convenient. We have been locked out entirely because it is a wind-up who did the killing.
Narong's voice cracks with a sudden intensity.
We must know if the wind-up was planted by your ministry.
He passes her a bundle of cash. Kanya stares at the amount, shocked.
Bribe anyone who gets in your way,
he says. She shakes off her paralysis, takes the money and stuffs it into her pockets. He touches her gently.
I am very sorry, Kanya. You're all I have. I depend on you to find our enemies and root them out.
The heat of a Plunchet tower in the middle of the day is stifling. Investigators clog the dingy rooms of the club, adding to the swelter. It is a sick place to die. A place of hunger and desperation and appetites unfilled. Palace staffers crowd in the halls, watching, conferring, preparing to collect the Somdet Chaupraya's body for placement in his funeral urn, waiting as Pracha's people investigate. Anxiety and anger hang in the air. Politeness filed to an exquisite edge in this most humiliating and frightening moment. The rooms have the feeling of the monsoon just about to break, electric with energy, fraught with the unknown darkness of roiling clouds. The first body lies on the floor outside, an old farang, surreal and alien. There is little physical damage to him, except the bruising where his throat was crushed, the livid torture that was done to his windpipe. He sprawls beside the bar, with the mottled look of a corpse raised from the river. Some gangster bit of fish bait. The old man stares at her with wide blue eyes, two dead seas. Kanya studies the damage without speaking, then allows General Pracha's secretary to lead her to the interior rooms. She gasps. Blood stains everything. Great swirls of it spatter the walls and drool across the floors. Bodies lie in tangled heaps, and among them lies the Somdet Chalpraya. His throat not smashed, as was the old Farang, but literally torn out, as though a tiger has fed upon him. His bodyguards lie dead, one with a spring gun blade buried in his eye socket, the other still clutching his own spring gun but peppered with blades.
Khotrai,
Kanya murmurs. She hesitates, uncertain of what to do in the presence of this sordid death. Ivory beetles tangle in the bloody froth. They skitter and scatter through it all, making tracks in the coagulant. Pracha is in the room, conferring with his subordinates. He looks up at her gasp of dismay. The others have their own looks of shock, anxiety, and embarrassment flickering on their faces. The thought that Pracha could arrange such a killing fills Kanya with sickness. The Somdet Chalpraya was no friend of the Environment Ministry, but the enormity of the act makes her ill. It is one thing to plot coups and counter-coups, another to reach inside the palace. She feels like a bamboo leaf, drowning in floodwater currents.
So we all go, she tells herself.
Even the richest and the most powerful are only meat for Cheshire's in the end.
We are all nothing but walking corpses, and to forget it is folly. Meditate on the nature of corpses, and you will see this.
And yet still she is unnerved, almost panicked by the sight of a near god's mortality before her.
What have you done, General?
It is too horrifying to consider. The flood currents threaten to suck her under.
Kanya?
Pracha waves her over. She searches her general's face for signs that he carries the guilt for this act, but Pracha seems only puzzled.
What are you doing here?
I...
She has words prepared, excuses, but they fail her with the Crown Protector and his retinue strewn about the room. Pracha's eyes follow her gaze to the Protector's body. His voice softens. He touches her gently on the arm.
Come, this is too much.
Guides her out.
I...
Pracha shakes his head.
You've heard already.
He sighs.
By the end of the day, it will be all over the city.
Kanya finds her voice, spills her lie, pretending to the role that Narong has given her.
I didn't think it could be true.
Worse than that.
Pracha shakes his head grimly.
It was a wind-up that did it.
Kanya forces herself to show surprise. She glances back at the bloodshed.
A wind-up? Just one?
Her eyes trace along a peppering of spring blades embedded in the walls. She recognizes one of the other bodies as a trade ministry official, the son of a secondary patriarch. Another from a Chaozhou manufacturing clan, a man making his way in the business press. All of them faces from the whisper sheets. All of them great tigers.
It's awful.
It doesn't seem possible, does it? 6 bodyguards. 3 men additionally. And only a single wind-up, if we believe the witnesses.
Pracha shakes his head.
Even Sibiscosis kills more cleanly.
His Eminence, the Somdet Chalpraya's neck has been ripped entirely away, breaking it, snapping and tearing, so that though the spine seems attached still, it acts as a hinge rather than a support.
It looks like a demon tore him open.
A wild animal, anyway.
It's the sort of thing a military gene hack would do. We've seen this sort of activity in the north, where the Vietnamese operate. They use Japanese wind-ups as scouts and shock troops. We're lucky they don't have many. He looks seriously at Kanya. It will go hard on us. Trade will say that we failed in this, that we allowed this animal into the country. They'll try to take advantage, make a pretext out of it to seize more power. His expression turns bleak. We have to find out why this wind-up was here. If Akarat has set us up, has used the protector as a pawn to seize power.
He would never.
Pracha makes a face of dismissal. Politics is ugly. Never doubt what small men will do for great power. We think Akarat was here before. Some of the staff seem to recognize his image, seem to recall. He shrugs. But of course everyone is afraid. No one wants to admit too much. But it looks as if Akarat and some of his Farang trader friends brought the Sondet Chao Phraya to the Hichikichi.
Is he playing me? Does he know that I work for Akarat?
Kanya stifles her fears. If he knew, he would never have promoted me to Jaidi's position.
Jaidi whispers in her ear.
You never know. A snake in its nest is better than a snake slithering through the jungle. This way, he always knows exactly where you are.
I need you to go to the records department. Pracha says, we don't want information to conveniently disappear, you understand. Trade has its own agents amongst us. Pull everything you find and bring it to me. Find out how she lived here and survived. As soon as word gets out, there will be a cover-up. Men will lie. Permit records will disappear. Someone was allowing the wind-up to exist against all our laws. The ministry is vulnerable on this. Someone took the bribes. Someone allowed the wind-up to live here. I want to know who, and I want to know if they are on Akarat's payroll.
Why me? Pracha smiles sadly.
Jaidi is the only one I would trust more.
He's setting you up? Jaidi comments. If he wants to blame this on trade, you're the perfect tool. The mole in the ministry.
There is no guile in Pracha's face, but he is a clever man.
How much does he know?
Find the information for me, Pracha says. Bring it to me and speak to no one of this.
I will do it,
she says. Inside, though, she wonders if the records even exist anymore. So many ways to profit. A cover-up would have already been effected. If it is truly a murder plot against the protector, the payoffs would go to all levels. She shivers, wonders who would do such a thing. Political killings are one thing. To touch the palace in this way? Rage and frustration threaten to overwhelm her. She forces it down. What do we know of the wind-up so far?
She claimed to be a Japanese discard. The girls here say she has been in place for years.
Kanya makes a face of distaste.
It's difficult to believe that anyone would soil,
she breaks off, finding herself on the verge of scorning the Sondet Chao Phraya. Sick feelings of confusion and sadness overwhelm her. She masks her discomfort by asking another question.
How did the protector come to be here?
All we know is that he was accompanied by Akarat's ilk.
Will you question Akarat?
If we could find him.
He's missing?
You're surprised?
Akarat was always good at protecting himself. It's why he managed to survive so many times. Pracha grimaces. He might as well be a Cheshire. Nothing ever touches him. Pracha looks at her seriously.
We must find who allowed this wind-up creature to live here so long. How it got into the city. How the assassination was arranged. We are blind in this, and when we are blind, we are vulnerable. This news will make everything unstable.
Kanya Wise, I will do everything I can.
Even if Jaidi peers over her shoulder and laughs at her.
I may need more information than this to track down those responsible.
You have enough to start. Find where this wind-up came from. Who took the bribes? This is what I must know.
And Akarat and the Svarang who introduced the wind-up to the Protector?
Pracha smiles slightly. I will attend to it.
But,
Kanya, it is understandable that you wish to do more. We all care for the well-being of the palace and the kingdom. But we must secure and protect the information we have about this wind-up creature.
Kanya controls her response.
Yes, of course. I will locate the information on the bribes.
She pauses delicately.
Will someone be required to demonstrate their regrets as well?
Pracha makes a face. A little harmless bribe income is one thing. It is not a rich year for the ministry, but this... He shakes his head.
I remember when we were respected.
Kanya murmurs. Pracha glances at her. Do you? I thought that it ended by the time you came to us. He sighs. Don't worry. This will not be a cover-up. Atonements will be made. I will ensure it personally. Do not doubt my commitment to the kingdom or Her Royal Majesty the Queen. The guilty will be punished.
Kanya studies the Protector's body and the dingy room where he met his end. A wind-up. A whore and a wind-up. She tries to contain her sickness at the thought. A wind-up. That someone would try to...
She shakes her head.
An ugly affair. A destabilizing move. And now some young men will have to pay for it.
Whoever took the bribes in Planchette. Perhaps others.
On the street, Kanya flags down a cycle rickshaw. From the corner of her eye, she catches a glimpse of palace panthers formed in ranks at the door. A crowd is gathering, watching with interest. In a few more hours, rumors and news will be all over the city.
The Environment Ministry, as quickly as you can.
She waves Akarat's bribe money at the rickshaw man, encouraging greater effort. But even as she does, she wonders on whose behalf she waves it.
Chapter 33. At noon, an army truck arrives. It's a huge thing, gouting exhaust, astonishingly loud, like something out of the old expansion. She can hear it coming from a block away, but even with so much warning, she almost cries out when she sees the thing so fast, so awfully loud. Once in Japan, Emiko saw a similar vehicle. Gendo-sama explained that it was powered by liquefied coal, astonishingly dirty and terrible for carbon limits, but almost magically powerful. As if a dozen megadons were chained within. Perfect for military applications, even if civilians could not justify either the power or the taxation. Exhaust clouds swirl blue around it as it comes to a halt. A small fleet of King Spring scooters sweep up behind, ridden by men wearing the black of the palace's panthers and the green of the army. Men begin to pour from the truck and charge for Anderson Sama's tower entrance.
Emiko crouches lower in her alley hiding place.
At first she thought to flee, but before she had gone a block, she realized there was no place left to run. Anderson Sama was her only raft left in the raging ocean. And so she remains close by, watching the hive of ants,
that is Anderson Sama's tower, trying to understand. She's still astounded that the people who came crashing through the door were not, in fact, white shirts.
They should have been. In Kyoto, the police would have already hunted her down with sniffer dogs, and she would have already been compassionately put down.
She has never heard of a new person so completely failing to show obedience. Certainly not anything like her own ugly bloodletting and flight. She burns with shame and hatred at the same time. She cannot stay, and yet it is more than apparent that the Gaijin's apartment, invaded though it is her last place of safety. The city around her is no friend. More men pour from the military truck. Emiko slips deeper into the alley as they approach, expecting them to widen their search, preparing herself for a burst of heat and motion to escape. If she runs, she can reach the klong and cool herself before fleeing again. But they only post themselves along the major thoroughfares and do not seem to care to search for her. Another flurry of motion. Panthers dragging out a pair of burlapped hooded men with pale hands. Gaijin, for certain. One of them is Anderson Sama, she thinks. The clothes are his. They shove him forward, making him stumble. He slams into the back of the truck. Cursing, two of the Panthers drag him aboard. They cuff him beside the other Gaijin. More troops swarm inside, surrounding them. A limousine sweeps up to the curb, purring with its own coal diesel engine. It's strange and silent in comparison to the roar of the troop carrier, but the exhaust is the same. A rich man's vehicle. Almost unimaginable that someone could be so wealthy. Emiko gasps. It's Trade Minister Akarat being hustled by bodyguards into the car. Onlookers pause and stare. Emiko gawks with them. Then the limousine is moving and the troop carrier as well, its massive engine roaring. The two vehicles tear down the street, trailing clouds of smoke, and disappear around the corner. Silence rushes into the void, almost physical after the rumble of the truck engine. She hears people murmuring.
Political? Akarat? Farang? General Pracha?
But even with her excellent hearing, it makes no sense. She stares after the truck. With determination, she might follow. She gives up the idea. It is impossible. Wherever Anderson Sama has gone, she cannot involve herself. Whatever political problem he has become entangled in will end with the ugliness of all such conflicts. Emiko wonders if she can simply slip back inside the apartment now that everyone is gone. Near the building's entrance, a pair of men have begun handing out flyers to everyone they can reach. Another pair coast past on a cargo bike. It's been stacked with more flyers. One man jumps down and sticks a flyer to a lamppost before hopping back up on the slowly moving bike. Emiko starts toward the bike to collect a flyer herself, but a prickle of paranoia stops her. Instead, she lets them rattle past, then cautiously approaches the light pole to read what they have posted. She moves carefully, all her energy focused on making her movement appear natural, trying not to draw undue attention. She pushes gently into a gathering crowd, bumping against them, craning for a view over the sea of black hair and straining bodies. An angry murmur rises. Someone sobs. A man turns away, his eyes wide with grief and terror. He shoves past her. Emiko slips forward into the gap. The murmur grows. Emiko eases closer. Careful, careful, slow, slow. Her breath catches. The Somdet Chaopraya, the protector of Her Majesty the Queen. And words. She forces her brain to work to translate from Thai to Japanese, and as she does, she becomes aware of the people all around her, the people who press in on every side, all of them reading about a wind-up girl, who walks amongst them, a wind-up, who slaughters the Queen's own protector, an agent of the Environment Ministry, a creature of deadly power. People jostle around her as they try to read, shoving closer, squeezing past, all of them thinking she is one of them. All of them allowing her to live, only because they do not yet see. Chapter 34.
Will you sit down? Your pacing makes me nervous.
Hak-Sung pauses in the perambulation of his hovel to glare at Laughing Chan.
I pay for your calories, not the other way around.
Laughing Chan shrugs and goes back to playing cards. They've all been huddled in the room for the last several days. Laughing Chan is a congenial companion, along with Pak Eng and Peter Kwok. But even the most congenial company... Hak-Sung shakes his head. It doesn't matter. The storm is coming. Bloodshed and mayhem on the horizon. It's the same feeling he had before the incident, before his sons were beheaded and his daughters raped senseless. And he sat in the middle of that brewing storm, willfully ignorant, telling anyone who would listen that the men in KL would never let what had happened down in Jakarta happen to the good Chinese here. After all, were they not loyal? Did they not contribute? Did he not have friends at every level of government who assured him that the green headbands were but a bit of political posturing? The storm was surging all around him, and he had refused to accept it. But not this time. This time he is prepared. The air is electric with what is about to occur. Ever since the white shirts closed down the factories, it was apparent. And now, it is about to break. And this time, he is ready. Hak-Sung smiles to himself, examines his little bunker with its stores of money and gems and food.
Is there any more word on the radio?
He asks. The three men exchange glances. Laughing Chan nods at Pak Eng.
It's your turn to wind it.
Pak-Eng scowls and goes over to the radio. It's an expensive device, and Hak-Sung is regretting that he purchased it at all. There are other radios in the slums, but lurking beside them draws attention, and so he spent money on this one, unsure if it would even carry anything other than rumor, and yet unable to deny himself another source of information. Pak-Eng kneels beside the thing and starts to wind it. Its speaker crackles to life, barely loud enough over the whine of the crank.
You know, if you fitted this with a decent gear system, it would be a lot more efficient.
Everyone ignores him, their attention entirely focused on the tiny speaker. Music. Sawduang. Hak-Sung crouches by the radio, listening intently. Changes the dial. Hak-Gang is starting to sweat. He winds for another 30 seconds and stops, puffing.
There. That should last a little while.
Hak-Sung works the dial on the machine, listening to the divining winds of radio waves. Twirls across stations, nothing but entertainments, music. Laughing Chan looks up.
What time is it?
4, perhaps.
Hak-Sung shrugs.
There should be Muay Thai. They should be doing the opening rituals by now.
Everyone exchanges glances. Hak-Sung moves through more stations. Music only, no news, nothing. And then a voice, filling all the stations, speaking as one voice and one station. They all crouch round, listening.
Akarat, I think.
Hak-Sung pauses.
The son de Chao Phraya has died. Akarat is blaming the white shirts.
He looks at them all.
It is beginning.
Pak Eng and Laughing Chan and Peter all look at Hak-Sung with respect.
You were right.
Hak-Sung nods impatiently.
I learn.
The storm is gathering.
The Megadonts must do battle. It is their fate. The